It's a bit of a miracle that I'm even here this morning because I was several miles away. I had a blowout on my tire. And I said, no problem, I know how to change a tire. Got the tire out and said, where's the jack? And where's the little thing to get the lugs off? And so I called my son and he said, oh yeah, that. So I'm thinking, okay, I got AAA, but it'll probably be an hour before I could get to the class. This isn't looking good. And then I thought, well, you know, this is a small car. Maybe I could. And I was working on the lugs and saying, you know, it almost fits. If I can just get, you know, hail two guys to hold the car up, maybe I can make this work. And then suddenly, this group showed up. What's it called? Metro Freeway Service Patrol. They were right there. Within a few minutes, I was on my way. So guess what I'm going to be doing this afternoon? So, no, I'll forgive my son. But yeah, he told me he doesn't even know where the jack is. So says, I think I loaned it to a friend. So yeah, I'm going to have to buy a jack and buy the right kind of lug remover and get some new tires. So
isn't that funny how they always get you when you need something?
Yeah. But you know, the wonderful thing was, here is this guy, and he says, yeah, he says, I don't normally patrol this route, but I saw you, and he stopped and took care of it just like that. So
are they? You, are they volunteers?
Well, your tax dollars pay for it. It's free. He wouldn't take any money. I didn't have to sign anything. But turned out he wanted to know what I was, you know, he says, are you in a hurry to get somewhere? And he says, yes. And so I told him about the class, and he said, do you have anything on the class? So I was able to give him the DVD, so who knows. Maybe it was preordained that I had that flat tire this morning. You know, something else that's preordained is July 3rd. You know what's special about July 3rd? That's when we're farthest away from the sun. So, and
didn't seem like it.
Didn't seem like
it.
Well, not too long, a few centuries, we're going to be farthest away from the sun on July 4th. So you'll be able to celebrate July 4th at the same day, celebrate being farthest away from the sun. But the fact that we're farthest away from the sun is a blessing for those of us who live in the northern hemisphere, because it makes our summers milder and our winters milder. And if you recall, a couple of weeks ago I was talking to you about the amazing fact that we're in an extremely unusual ice age cycle. All previous ice age cycles, the temperature goes up from an ice age very rapidly to a peak, and then it drops and you get back into an ice age that lasts 90,000 years. This time window is about 10,000 years wide, but this time when the temperature jumped up, it didn't go up to a maximum, it stabilized, and it's been in that stable position for 9,000 years. Now, this is the most detailed of the ice core measures that we have of the past temperature of the Earth. This is the one in central northern Greenland called Neem, and it compares with these two others also in northern Greenland. And what's a little bit different is these, this is called N-grip and grip. You can actually see that the temperature went up to a maximum and has been slowly declining. However, if you look at the one in central northern Greenland, it shows that we're actually experiencing a very gradual rise. Probably even about, it's dead constant. So it all depends where you drill the core. And, you know, as I mentioned, astronomers and geologists have been wondering how come this ice age cycle is so different. All previous ice age cycles, at least the past 40 ice age cycles, we've seen the temperature dramatically rise, hit a peak, and drop. This time, it didn't go all the way to the top. It stopped and leveled off. Well, what has been published just this week is the fact that we are in that part. By the way, this cycle is driven predominantly by the variation in the shape of Earth's orbit. And so right now we're in the most circular part of Earth's orbit. When it becomes less circular, you get this. And the cycle is about 100,000 years. Yes?
What does that the Celsius scale represent there?
Okay. The zero point is kind of the average that we have for the past 300 or 400 years. So that's the zero point. That's the mean global temperature. So everything's relative to the global mean temperature of the past several centuries. And so when it says -2, that's 2 degrees less than the global mean. And then +2 is 2 degrees more. It's a relative scale, yeah. But this has got nothing to do with the freezing point of water. It's all relative to the current mean temperature. But what we do notice is that in all previous ice ages, when the temperature rose to 3 or 4 degrees above where it is now, the temperature dramatically drops, and drops fairly rapidly. And I think I've mentioned this before. One of the prevailing models is what happens when the temperature goes up a little warmer than it is right now, it melts the polar ice cap. And with the polar ice cap being melted, you get more evaporation of polar water, which drops more snow on Siberia and Canada, which initiates an ice age. The only thing stopping an ice age right now is that both Siberia and Canada, northern Canada, get only 10 inches of rain a year. So the fact that you only get that 10 inches, they're basically deserts. And because there are deserts, we don't have an ice age. But if you were to bring that up to, say, 20 inches of precipitation equivalent, then you get thousands of feet of ice building up over Canada and Siberia. And the last ice age, the ice went all the way down here into central California. That's what carved out Yosemite. Yes?
Does that mean that the global warming that we're concerned with, that we are causing, could actually trigger a cooling period?
That's a concern. Now, we're going to have, I think we're talking to our global warming expert. The fellow is the president of our Knoxville chapter. Kevin Birdwell is going to be here later, and we're trying to schedule him to come and speak to this class. So he's the guy who can answer all your questions. But what he would tell you is this, is that our global climatology models are still in their infancy. So everything I'm saying here is meant to be taken with a grain of salt. It's a reasonable proposition, but our models simply aren't good enough to tell us for sure what's going to happen. But yeah, I mean, one reason why there's some concern about anthropogenic warming of the planet, we might warm it to a degree where we bring about a rapid ice age, which wouldn't be good, at least for those of us who have Canadian relatives. Not a good thing. So, yes.
To understand it better, because, you know, listening to you talk about this over the years, the Earth, we're in a period where we want to go into an ice age. And recent, like within the last 100-150 years of human activity, you know, we've added a lot of carbon monoxide to the atmosphere. So our activities are not warming the Earth, we're just kind of preventing it from cooling. Is that better?
Well, yeah, I mean, because of human activity, we've put off the ice age by about 5,000 years. We're literally 5,000 years overdue for the next ice age. So a lot of people think human activity, particularly cows, have staved off the onset of the next ice age. But now there's concern that if we burn too many fossil fuels, we could actually bring it on. But the problem is we don't have good enough climatology models to figure out what we should do, which makes this politically challenging. If you don't have good models so you know what's right to do, you could actually make things worse by your political decisions. Now, I asked my friend Kevin Birdwell, how long is it going to take before we got the kind of climatology models that we can give sound advice to our politicians? He said at least 100 years off. So we're going to have to be patient. Hold the line for a little longer. However, one of the things that's been described recently is it could be that this July 3rd thing has a lot to do with why we have this long, stable period where things have been optimal. And by the way, I'm arguing that this is not totally an accident, because of all the temperatures you want as a global mean to launch and sustain global high-technology civilization, the temperature we have right now is the best. if we were 1 degree colder or 1 degree warmer, we wouldn't be able to sustain the level of economic and technological activity that we do right now. And so could it be that the Lord planned this all along to give us this nice 9,000 year window when we got the optimal global temperature? But part of it is the fact that we have this July 3rd thing, namely that we are farthest from the sun in the summertime and closest in the wintertime, which means you're going to have milder winters and milder summers if you live in the northern hemisphere. But notice that most of the world's people, in fact, most of the world's land masses are in the north. So here's the equator. Now, in terms of this benefit from being farthest from the sun in the northern wintertime, this is going to work well for all people that live about 35 or 40 degrees south and north. So you can draw a line right about here. Okay, anybody above that line is actually going to benefit from that situation. Anybody below that line is going to have real problems. However, how many people are below that line? Okay, you've got a little bit here of Argentina and Chile, a little bit of the South Island of New Zealand, and of course Antarctica, and that's it. And so what we notice here is that the continental land masses are such that more than 90% of the land area is above that line. Now, if it was the other way around, we would have serious problems. Now, as I mentioned, if we wait long enough, we're going to be farthest from the sun on July 4th, and it's going to move to July 5th and July 6th. What's going on there? It's called the precession. Any of you remember, I don't know if they have these toys anymore, but when I was young, they had these spinning top toys. You know, you have a little thing where you pull a string and it spins really rapidly, and you can see the rotation of the spinning top, but you'll also notice that it precesses, that you'll see the thing slowly do this. Well, that's true of all celestial spinning bodies. They precess. And the Earth has a precession. And the precession is about 26,000 years long. So, come 25,014, we're going to be closest to the sun on July 3rd, not farthest from the sun on July 3rd. So 13,000 years from now, we're going to be closest to the sun in the summertime, which is going to make our summers really hot and our winters really cold, and that's when you're all going to want to move to the southern tip of South America. But obviously not everybody can move there. There's not that much land area there. But that allows us, I think that's part of the reason why we've been benefiting from what's called the long warm spring, where we're just 3 degrees below that maximum temperature, and where for 9,000 years, instead of the temperature rising and dropping, it's been flat. Now, it's obviously more complex than that, and as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, this is still an unsolved mystery. Why only this time, in this ice age cycle, have we had this 9,000 year flat at the very best temperature for the planet, where we got the very best orientation? And by the way, what you notice about these continents, they're predominantly oriented north-south. Now, the benefit of that, and by the way, and they're separated by big oceans. Now, every quarter of a billion years, the continents come together, and then they pull apart. And there's been several of those throughout the Earth's history. But right now, we've got them pulled apart, where they're oriented north-south, where you've got big oceans between them, and that's the best possible orientation to distribute precipitation over all the continental land masses. So one of the problems of living with a supercontinent, where all the continents come together, is you've got this big continental landmass where a good chunk of that landmass is a long ways from ocean water, which means it becomes a gigantic desert. And in that case, people would be forced to live around the outer edge. But it's worse than that, because if you've got a big supercontinent, you're not going to break up the jet stream. And if you watch the weather every night, you'll see the weatherman talking about the jet stream. You know, well, the jet stream is actually up in Seattle, so they're getting rain and we're not. But because of the way these continents are oriented, every once in a while the jet stream drops south and we get rain. Enough rain that we can sustain crops in the San Joaquin Valley. And, you know, feed the rest of the country thereby. But it's because of the orientation of the continents, it forces the jet streams to move up and down in latitude. If you've got a supercontinent, you're going to have something similar to what you see on Jupiter, where you've got these laminar cloud layers, and the winds simply blow at one latitude. Now, actually, that does happen in the southern hemisphere. Because they don't have land masses extending very far south, you've got what's called the Roaring Forties. Ever remember being taught that in school? I have to keep asking because my wife says that schools in California aren't the same as schools elsewhere. But what you notice is when you get down to about this latitude here, there's no land mass to break things up. And so the winds will blow very strong here, which is what was such a challenge when Magellan tried to round the Cape here. He knew he was going to be exposed to those strong winds, and that could potentially damage his ship. Well, those winds still blow, and they blow across, but the problem is rain falls in one swath only. So you get some rain in southern New Zealand, rain down here, but elsewhere it's quite dry. That doesn't happen in the northern hemisphere because you've got these huge continents oriented north-south that forces the jet streams to move up and down, and therefore rainfall and snow gets evenly distributed up and down. The other thing that's a benefit, particularly for North and South America, is you've got a huge chain of mountains that runs all the way down the length. Notice that the mountains are north and south. The fact that the mountains run north and south, forces rain to fall rather evenly distributed from the north all the way down to the south. The other big benefit is the highest mountains are towards the equator, which means that all through North and South America, you've got snow that will be deposited on the mountains, such that you've got snow melt that will feed the streams and rivers and allow you to grow crops year-round towards the equator. So, yes.
Is there a jet stream in the southern hemisphere too?
There's several jet streams, but the problem here is you got this powerful jet stream that runs here, but it's not forced to go up and down because it doesn't run on any continental land masses. And the winds are very strong, stronger than you want. I mean, they call it the Roaring Forties because it's in the low 40 latitudes, but it never is less than 40 miles an hour. And so it's the Roaring Forties in both senses of the word. Question over here.
I just wanted to mention earlier that the case for anthropogenic warming is actually quite inconclusive, that some very credible work shows that it's anywhere from 5% to 80% of the tropospheric temperature changes. And especially in the last 200 years, which is the only period which can make any argument for anthropogenic warming, most of it is explained by cyclical ocean currents that have a far greater heat content and determination of the climate than the atmosphere.
Well, when Kevin Birdwell comes to his class, he's going to confirm what you're saying, that in terms of the heating of the planet, we know that at least 20% comes from human source. It could be as high as 80%. Well, likewise, the natural cycles, such things as the fact that our Earth's orbit goes through this 100,000-year cycle, and then there's this 26,000-year cycle. There's actually a third cycle, a 41,000-year cycle, and that's the cycle of the tilt of the plane of Earth's orbit relative to the solar system. These three factors work to change the climate. It's called the Milankovitch cycles. And so there are times when we get an ice age every 41,000 years, times we get it every 100,000 years. There are times you get a super ice age every 2 million years. It all depends on the interaction of these different cycles. But right now, we have the benefit that because of the orientation of the continents, precession is out of sync with the 100,000-year cycle, at least right now, and that may be part of the reason why we had especially benign condition. But again, it kind of raises your point. If your data is only good to say it's somewhere between 20 and 80%, then it's really difficult to come up with appropriate solutions, which is why I'm suggesting in my book over there, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, given that our uncertainties are that big, it'd be wise to only do things to ameliorate global warming that are simultaneously beneficial to cooling the planet, at the same time give an economic payoff. If you have things between 20 and 80%, then it's not a good idea to pass draconian laws where people have to make considerable economic sacrifices. Number one, you won't be able to enforce them. And number two, with uncertainties that large, you could actually make things worse rather than better. And really, the message that you see in the book of Job is that we're to pay attention to precipitation. I would agree we should pay attention to temperature as well, but notice that it emphasizes precipitation. And we humans have done things to seriously disrupt the precipitation patterns, and they're relatively easy to correct. So I would say to the politicians, start there. Because if we correct that, it's going to boost the economy, you're going to grow more crops, you're going to make for a better economy worldwide, and we do know that it's going to help ameliorate the global warming that we are experiencing. Yes?
Anybody know the outcome of heavy metal particulates on the atmosphere? I've been reading a lot about like barium and certain titanium,
Well, for example, there's a few papers published where they're saying it's not global warming that's the biggest factor in melting the polar ice cap, it's dust, industrial dust. And the industrial dust falling on the polar ice cap is actually causing it to absorb more heat, and that's what's melting the polar ice cap. Anyway, again, it kind of underlines the point. There's still a lot of uncertainties here. But what's interesting, if you look at, say, people are saying carbon dioxide that we're emitting from our industrial activity is warming the planet. What's really interesting, if you look at maps, and I got a slide of this, but I can't bring it up quickly. It's a slide, and you can see this online, where it shows where the anthropogenic carbon dioxide emission is falling on the Earth. You would think it'd be even over the whole planet. It's not. So, for example, all the carbon dioxide that's being produced by Chinese industry is basically pooling in northern Canada. And that's, again, having a big impact on melting the polar ice cap, the fact that it goes there. So, you know, where you burn the carbon dioxide may have nothing to do with where the carbon dioxide winds up. You know, there's no industry in northern Canada, but all those big factories in China, their carbon dioxide gets carried up there, and that's actually the place where you got the greatest concentration of anthropogenic carbon dioxide, and hardly any down here in Antarctica, which might be explaining why it appears, at least now, that the Antarctic ice is growing, whereas the Arctic ice is shrinking. So a lot of it has to do with where this stuff goes. And if Kevin Birdwell were here, he would just say that simply adds to the complexity of these climatology models. You can't do global averages. Global averages will not give you the whole picture. Yes?
His comment about 100 years before we have a good model, is that because we need to be gathering this kind of precise data in different regions and whatnot? Is that kind of the idea? So I would think you could come up with a model if somebody's smart enough just in a short period of time, but if it's a matter of gathering more data before you can develop the model, that's what I'm wondering.
Well, there's two factors. You know, again, if you were here, you'd say we simply don't have the supercomputing power available that's needed to do the job, nor do we have the data to put into the supercomputer. And what we need is a lot more variables, because the models that have been done so far are not taking into account all the necessary variables. So, for example, I just mentioned, you know, where the carbon dioxide winds up. The geography is a factor. That needs to be put into the models. And not just for carbon dioxide. You want to do it for water vapor. You want to do it for methane. That just makes things a lot more challenging. And you need more than 100 years worth of data. That's about what we have right now, is 100 years of reliable data to really make a good sense of these models. You want a couple of centuries worth of good data, which means it's going to take longer.
You know, as far as your jet stream and that latitude not being impeded, the jet streams are up higher, but were you talking about lower elevation winds being strong, like they would affect Magellan and that sort of thing?
Well, that's a factor. I mean, the jet streams are up high, but they are impacted by topography they run into. And one of the problems down here is the mountains are a lot lower in elevation than they are up here. Here you got 20,000 foot high mountains. Down here, they're 7,000 feet. And so that becomes an issue. And by the way, you only got a little sliver of land, so it's not going to do much.
Okay. So is the effect of northern hemisphere jet streams being moved around, broken up, and whatnot, and slowed down, if you will, because of the topography? Is that the primary driver?
Yes, but there are other factors. I mean, again, if Kevin were here, he says not enough just to look at the atmospherics. You've got to look at what's going on in the oceans, because there's a complex interplay between the jet stream and what's happening in the oceans. And so you want to look at the ocean currents. And again, what you see here is the ocean currents are pretty laminar, whereas up in the Atlantic, they go north-south. And so northern Europe is a lot warmer than otherwise would be because of the Gulf Stream. And so a lot of these models that are predicting the next ice age say maybe it happens when the Gulf Stream shuts down. Because if the Gulf Stream shuts down, then you're going to get ice forming over northern Europe and eastern Canada and Greenland. So it's complicated. And I think that's something you're going to hear abundantly from Kevin when he gets here, because it is really complicated.
What time frame were you thinking of that he might be here? Would it be next couple of months, 6 months from now?
I think he's going to be here for about a six-month wide window. So he's going to be here as a visiting scholar for a significant time. He's actually writing a book on global warming and the Christian faith, kind of what the Bible has to say about it, what we know scientifically, and he's going to be with us to try to make some headway on that. One of the things he's going to be talking about, too, is that this particular orientation is relatively recent. I mean, what is one of the most fertile areas of the world? The Indian subcontinent. Where was the Indian subcontinent a few tens of millions of years ago? It was attached to Antarctica, which wouldn't have done anybody any good to have the Indian subcontinent down here. And then it got attached to Madagascar in southern Africa when they were a little bit further south. And what happened is that the Indian subcontinent split off and rapidly sped towards Asia. In fact, it still ranks as the most rapid movement of continental landmass to this day. And so it crashed into Asia, and now you've got this incredibly fertile subcontinent right where you want it, in a nice tropical area. And by the way, when it smashed into Asia, what happened? The ocean floor that was in between, again, a very fertile area, the ocean floor was in between, got crumpled up, and that formed the Himalayas. And because of the Himalayas, you've got vast glaciers close to the equator. And the melting of those glaciers is what's really keeping China and India able to grow all the crops that they do. I mean, those are the two most populous nations of the world, but they're vitally dependent on the Himalayas. And the Himalayas weren't there just a few, well, literally, go back 20 million years ago, they weren't there. India just crashed into this subcontinent quite recently. And by the way, those Himalayas are getting taller and taller. India is still moving towards Russia. They're getting closer and closer together as that collision still continues. But what it did is it put one of the most fertile land masses on the entire planet exactly where you want it, and with the mountain range, in order to make sure there's sufficient water flowing all year round to enable both China and India to grow tremendous quantities of crops and therefore support literally 2 billion of the world's population.
What made it so fertile?
Well, what makes it fertile is that it will accumulate certain minerals as a result of tectonics. So, for example, you'll get the formation of what's called these iron formations. And so if you've got sufficient water... By the way, Australia was down here at one time, too. It split off and moved north. So you wouldn't be able to have that. Australia is mainly a desert, but we do notice it's iron rich. And that's because of past events over the literally. You got to go back to what's called the Boring Billion. Say, what's the Boring Billion? That's a window between when the Earth was about 2 billion years old to a billion years old, where nothing much happened. Well, that's what the textbooks say, but really a lot was happening. This is when the enrichment of these continental land masses with minerals and soils was taking place, setting everything up for today. So now there's been a paper published where they're saying the not-so-boring billion, because what was happening during that billion years is literally everything was being prepared. And by the way, a lot of that mineral development is thanks to ice. And so you need the ice ages to build up the minerals. I think I showed you that slide a month ago where you look at how many minerals you get without ice, which is about a maximum of maybe 1,400 minerals. But if you've got regular ice ages, you wind up with a planet with about 4,600 minerals, which is what you need to sustain civilization. So yes, when your family celebrates Thanksgiving, you want to thank God for all those ice ages, how regular those ice ages were, and particularly how severe the last ice age was. Because the last ice age made it all the way down into central California, and because of that, we wound up with a special enrichment of minerals that did not take place in previous ice ages. All there for us to mine. We wouldn't have had a... didn't they have some kind of a gold rush here in California? 1848? Something like that, yeah. Well, notice there were gold rushes all up and down North and South America. But a lot of that's thanks to the Ice Age that we have that. Yes?
I was wondering, are there volcanoes or volcanism around India and the Himalayas? Or is that strictly mountain building? Why wouldn't there be volcanoes?
Well... what you've got in the Himalayas is basically tectonic uplift. There are some volcanoes there, but it's the volcanic uplift that's predominant. So,
is Kilimanjaro a volcano?
I don't know. Maybe somebody here would know. We were going to have some... what happened to our friend Lee, who is going to tell us all about Africa? He ought to know. So every missionary I know has gone to Africa has climbed Kilimanjaro. So it's kind of the thing to do, to go. You must know, right? It is a volcano. Okay. So.
What is 16?
16th?
Extinct.
It's an extinct volcano, which is why you can walk up it. And by the way, it literally is just a walk. If you just keep walking slowly, you will get to the top of Kilimanjaro. I'll tell you a funny one. Of all my missionary friends who have gone up Kilimanjaro, every woman has made it, only a few of the men make it. Because the men go too fast. If you go nice and slow, you will adapt to the... because, you know, it's over 19,000 feet at the summit. So if you don't take your time to adapt to the altitude, you're not going to make it. Yeah, go ahead.
When the Himalayas started to rise, do you think how long the process was before they got to their, you know, kind of current height?
Well, the collision with Asia began a little less than 20 million years ago, so they've been going up for the past 20 million years. They were below sea level because the Himalayas are essentially crumpled up seafloor, which is why you see seashells on the top of Mount Everest. It's crumpled up seafloor, so you get all these sea fossils showing up, you know, 29,000 feet above sea level. So yeah, it's been going on for that period of time. The current rate of growth is 17 millimeters of upward movement per year. So, and, you know, trivia question, where do you get the second fastest rate of mountain uplift?
Right here.
These San Gabriel Mountains are going up 9 millimeters a year. For those of you who live at the foothills, you are owners of future mountain property. Yes.
I think they're eroding a little bit faster, though.
They are eroding. And the Himalayas are eroding too. Glaciers are powerful eroders. My friends tell me in geophysics that even these hills are going up faster than they're being eroded. And that's certainly true of the Himalayas. They're going up faster than we're eroding them. Yes?
That's why it's harder for me to climb up these mountains this year than it was last year.
That's true. That is true. Yes. Yes, and that's, you know, I meant to start with our scripture text, which is a good reminder. Let me go there right now, because it kind of gives you the context of what's going on. And as I've been mentioning here, Proverbs 8, that's one of the three major texts in the Bible that parallel the 6 days of creation. It's the shortest of the three. The other two are Psalm 104 and Job 37, 38, and 39. But notice in Proverbs 3, you get a short summary of what you're going to get in Proverbs 8. So in Proverbs 3, I'll start in verse 17, because it talks about the one that's doing all this, wisdom, the Holy Spirit. It says, her ways are pleasant ways, all her paths are peace. She is a tree of life to those who embrace her. Those who lay hold of her will be blessed. And last week, I paralleled that with Hebrews 11:6. Anyone who comes to God must believe that He exists, and He rewards those who earnestly seek Him. And this is the whole point. God is created in such a way as to bring good things and pleasure to His creation. And if we embrace that, then we're going to be blessed. But it goes on in verse 19. By wisdom the Lord laid the earth's foundations. By understanding, He set the heavens in place. By His knowledge, the deeps were divided, and the clouds let drop their dew. Four things it's mentioning there. The universe, the earth, it's talking about the deep, the oceans, and the clouds, and the water cycle. So it's making those four points. And a whole point there here is that all four must be exquisitely designed by God if you're ever going to have human beings existing, where God can show good things to those human beings. Then we move on into Proverbs 8, and it basically expands upon that. So you get, you know, here's just kind of the summary. If you want the bottom line, it's there in Proverbs 3, 17 through to 20. But if you want to get into a little more detail, you find it at the end of the book of Proverbs chapter 8, starting in verse 22. The Lord possessed me at the beginning of His work, before the deeds of old. So right here in Proverbs 8, notice what's happening here, going from Genesis 1 to the Job text, to Psalm 104, to Proverbs 8. It immediately, in the account of creation, introduces the Trinity. I mean, you see the Trinity in Genesis 1, you see the Trinity right here. The Lord possessed me. It's not just one, there are two here, there are three here. And the whole point is this. Why did God create? He created to redeem. I mean, we talked about that last week. When you go to the New Testament, 2 Timothy 1:9, the grace of God that we now experience was put into effect before the beginning of time. Titus 1:2, the hope that we share in Christ was given to us before the beginning of time. Before God created anything, He had redemption in mind. He had grace in mind. So why do we have oceans? Why do we have clouds? Why do we have a water cycle? Why do we have a universe of 50 billion trillion stars? Why do we have this planet Earth? It's all been designed to bring about the redemption of human beings. That's why it's there. And that's kind of what you're going to be getting in Proverbs 8. It's going to be listing all the things that must be set in place in order for God's redemptive plan to have the impact that He intends. Now, why the Trinity? I mean, Ken Samples and I had this wonderful debate online with Jewish scholars. But partway through that debate, we started talking about the Trinity. And our challenge to the Jewish scholars was, all right, you believe that God is one and only one, and you believe that we Christians are believing in a false God where there's three persons and one essence. But you also believe, as Jews, that God is a God of love. How is it possible for God to be a being of love before He creates anything? If there's no one else around, how can He be a God of love? Love, by definition, requires another person to share that love with, to bestow that love upon. And the problem with the strict monotheistic religions is you've got a God that either has to create in order to experience love, or is not a loving being in the first place, which explains a lot of the theology of Islam. You know, like Jews, they believe that God is one and only one, just one person. But notice in Islam, God is very distant. The Muslims aren't even sure this is a God that cares for them. I mean, and it makes logical sense. If there's no other person, then where would that being have any context for love? Now, our Jewish friends came back and said, well, what do you do with Hinduism and Buddhism, where they got all kinds of gods? I mean, millions of gods. I says, but notice what you've got in Hinduism, for example. It is belief that in creation is filled with contradictions. Why is it filled with contradictions? Because all these gods disagree with one another. They've got different creation plans. They've got different motives, different objectives, different purposes. And that's the wonder of the Christian God. It's three persons and one essence, one purpose, one plan, one design. And therefore, in Christianity, we have this expectation that this world in which we live is harmonious and contradiction-free. That's what drives Western science. You know, we are going to run into anomalies as we study science, things that don't seem to fit. But what drives science is we know if we study the anomalies, then the apparent contradictions will disappear, because we have this belief that the realm of nature is totally harmonious, consistent, and free of contradiction. But again, that only makes sense if God is one essence and not many essences, not many plans, not many minds. So only in Christianity do you have a creation that actually is consistent with what we discover through our modern scientific endeavor. By the way, when we ask that question to our Jewish friends, you know, well, how do you explain love? They were silent, which is interesting, because Ken and I couldn't get a word in edgewise in the rest of the conversation. And Ken told me later, he says, Hugh, I wanted to bring that up just so that they wouldn't be talking all the time. So, and
I guess they got pinched, huh?
Well, they recognize the dilemma that if God is one person only, then where does love come from? And yet the heart of the Old Testament is that God is a being of love. And right here in the Old Testament, by the way, we went on to share with our Jewish friends these very texts. I says, notice, whenever the Old Testament speaks about creation, the triune God jumps off the page. God is making it clear that this creation in which we live is a creation that's going to reveal the manifestation of God's love for His creation and His love for His human beings in particular. That would not be possible unless God is a triune being. Well, let me move on before I take any more questions. I'm going to read through this whole text. And by the way, most people, when they speak about the creation chronology here, stop at verse 30. I'm going to take it all the way to the end. The Lord possessed me at the beginning of His work, before His deeds of old, before time existed, before the universe existed. I was appointed from eternity. In other words, I was with God from all eternity, from the beginning, before the world began. When there were no oceans, I was given birth. And by the way, what you're going to see here, when there was no. We need to put it in a positive context. Everything where it says there were no oceans, there were no whatever, each one of those things is crucial in order to bring about the existence of human beings, and especially redemption. So one of the challenges I'm going to give to this class is this. As we go down the list, why do we need oceans for redemption? Why do we need the mountains? Why do we need the dew? Why do we need 50 billion trillion stars? What is it about everything that's listed here that plays a crucial role in the redemption of humanity? When there are no oceans, I was given birth. When there are no springs abounding with water, before the mountains were settled in place, before the hills, I was given birth. Before He made the earth or its fields, or any of the dust of the world. And by the way, dust is not that easy to get. We live on a planet with dust. Dust and dirt, never take those things for granted. Because during the Boring Billion that we got all the dust and dirt we needed. That's another story. Okay. Or any of the dust of the world. I was there when he set the heavens in place, when he marked out the horizon on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above and fixed security the fountains of the deep, when he gave the sea its boundary so the waters would not overstep his command, and when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was a craftsman at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world, and delighting in mankind. So everything we talked about, all this is crucial for humans to receive redemption. But it goes on. Now then, my sons, listen to me. Blessed are those who keep my ways. Listen to my instruction and be wise. Do not ignore it. Blessed is the man who listens to me, watching daily at my doors, waiting at my doorway. Whoever finds me finds life and receives favor from Lord. And whoever fails to find me harms himself, and all who hate me love death. How do we find him? Well, told us up above that we recognize the role that God has played. Again, Hebrews 11:6. Anyone who comes to God must believe that he exists. How can we believe that he exists? Well, the heavens declare the glory of God. Romans 1, the entire creation testifies of God and testifies of his goodness. Anyone who comes to God must believe that he exists, and he rewards those who earnestly seek him. So notice that Proverbs 31 ends with an exhortation. Pursue this God. You know, come to the recognition that he really does exist, and everything that he has done in creation is to make it possible for you to redeem from your offenses against God and one another and receive rewards with God in the new creation. Whoever finds me finds a good thing. So how do you come to God? Look at the evidence that he exists and realize this is a good God. And this is important because a lot of people look at the creation and say, we got tornadoes, we got fires, we got earthquakes, we got poor people. And they say, how can that be a good God? Well, all of this is saying, yes, we need all of that for redemption to take place. And this is not the ultimate creation. That's something that struck me too when we were debating with these Jewish scholars, is that they have a very different view on what's going to happen next. And their view, and by the way, this is not true of all Jews, so don't get me wrong on this, but it was true of the ones we were dialoguing with, that they believe that the end result is God's going to restore the earth, make it a beautiful place like it was in the Garden of Eden, and will live on planet Earth for the rest of eternity. So of course I jumped in as an astronomer, said, well, you know, the sun's getting brighter, and eventually it's going to incinerate the earth, it's going to become a briquette. So we're probably not going to be able to stay here a whole lot longer. I just said that because of July 4th, right? So they immediately jump, well, when's that going to happen? And it says, well, it's guaranteed to happen in less than 3 billion years. So it says, well, maybe we just have a long period of time. But the problem is, all the New Testament tell us our redemption is eternal. It's not just going to be for a billion years. It's eternal. And therefore, everything we see here, where we complain and say, why the forest fires, why the earthquakes, all that's crucial for redemption to be possible. But when our redemption is finished, and you see that promise in Romans 8:23, the very moment that the full number of human beings that will receive redemption according to God's plan has been fulfilled, the purpose of the universe has been fulfilled, God no longer has a need for it, he's going to replace the universe with a brand new realm. But that won't happen until the redemptive work is complete, when evil is conquered, permanently removed. And what we see in the new creation is a new physics, new dimensions in the context of a realm where evil will never exist again. But as long as you've got evil around here, you're going to need the Himalayas, you're going to need the oceans, you're going to need all those stars, and you're going to need the earthquakes that come with it. And by the way, I'm going to be speaking later this year at a conference on what's called natural evil. And the theme of my talk is, we shouldn't be calling it natural evil. There is no such thing as natural evil, because we need earthquakes. Life would be a lot worse without earthquakes, given the laws of physics that God chose. And we notice is that we're living on a planet where we have the optimal number and intensity of earthquakes. We don't get magnitude 11 earthquakes. But neither do we have a planet where all we get is magnitude 6s. If that was the case, it'd be very easy to have no damage and no loss of life. But that wouldn't be adequate to recycle the nutrients and give us the resources we need to launch and sustain civilization and use that civilization to bring redemption to the full number of people that God intends, as he says in Romans 8. Yes?
In your book, The Why We Never Get Rated, you have stated that something about the millennium, that certain scholars believe there's going to be a millennium when Christ comes back. What is your take on that? Is there going to be a millennium, or is there going to be the new heavens and earth?
All right. Well, big disclaimer here. There is disagreement amongst our reason to believe scholars on the millennium. Ken Samples is an amillennialist, where he basically takes what the scripture says about the millennium as figures of speech. Dave Rogstad and I are premillennialists. We believe in the Bible speaks about this thousand-year period. It's literal. And one reason why I'm compelled to take it literally is what I see in Revelation 19 and 20. How at the beginning of the millennium, God locks up the false prophet and the Antichrist. And then they go into the lake of fire where they'll never be released. Whereas Satan, he too is locked up, but he's put in a temporary prison. And the text tells us that towards the very end of the millennium, he is released to test those who have not yet been tested. And what I write about and why the universe is the way it is why it's so crucial that every human being be tested. Because the new creation is a place where we'll never exercise our free will for evil intent. But the only way that can be guaranteed is that we're first subjected to the most challenging test possible in God's creation, and that's to be tempted by the most powerful creature God has ever made. If you can pass that test, there is no other test that can be a greater challenge to you. And therefore, God sees fit to make sure that every human being that's marked for redemption gets exposed to that test, which is why I believe it's crucial that Satan be released from his prison at the end of the millennium to test all those who had not yet been tested. And I say, well, why does God bother with all that? Couldn't he just skip the millennium? And that's kind of the comment that I get from Ken Samples. None of this is necessary. My own theology is you can make the same argument about the flood. Why did God have us live potentially 900 years plus? We're all going to die in less than 120 years. Although that's 120 plus or minus one or two, so I'm not bothering when people say we got records of someone lived to be 121. The scriptures are saying rounding it off to 120. But that is the limit, and we've got good science that tells us that it's impossible, no matter how healthy you live. Keep eating your broccoli, but it won't do any good to get you past that 120 years. But there was a time when humans could live 800 or 900 years. And if you get that book over there, Navigating Genesis, we tell you why that was possible in the days before the flood and not possible now. But the story we see here in the Old Testament is what happens when people are allowed to live that long. It's not good that we live that many years. The consequences were devastating. The description of the pre-flood peoples uses the strongest language considering their evil behavior and evil intent that you find anywhere in the Bible. And so long lifespans are not for the benefit of humanity. But notice what happens during the millennium. God once again allows people to live 800 or 900 years. It says a human will be considered to have died in their youth if they only make it to 200. So God once again is going to allow us to live a long time. Notice what else happens during the millennium is that we have Jesus Christ, the creator of the universe, ruling in downtown Jerusalem. I'm convinced you'll be able to see him on television every night on the news. You'll no longer say lousy government is the reason why we got problems. You're going to have an ideal government. By the way, my view of the millennium is based on Joel chapter 2, where the Lord returns, but he doesn't return alone. He comes back with his perfected saints from heaven. They come back with him. Why? Because he needs human beings that have been perfected of their sin behavior to help him rule over the whole of the earth. And so it's not just going to be Jesus in downtown Jerusalem. All the rulers in all of those cities and judges, they're going to have these people in place. You can't say, lousy local judge. No. That lousy local judge is someone who is now sin-free. And it's also going to be a time of a great economy. My belief of the millennium is that God sets up this thousand-year period where he actually removes every possible excuse for why we sin except the real one. And, you know, people like that. You know, why are you misbehaving? Well, I got bad parents. Lousy economic environment. I didn't have the right kind of upbringing. I was poor. It's all this meat that we're eating. So God takes that. We have global warming, all right? It's going to give us a perfect climate. So, and that's what's interesting about all these texts about the millennium. It's literally ticking off all the excuses for why we sin, except the one you see in Jeremiah 17, 9 and 10. We sin because our hearts are evil.
Are the people, though, that are going to be in the millennium the ones who are going to go through the tribulation and are going to live then, or what?
Well, when I told you I was a premillennialist, there are many different kinds of premillennialists. So, for example, Dave Rogstad and I have different premillennial views. My premillennial view is you're going to have two kinds of humans living in the millennium. You'll have those that have survived the Great Tribulation, have not yet received their perfected bodies, and they will bear children during the millennium. And that's why Satan is released, because one of the things God does during the millennium, you think the guy in the red union suit is the one that caused you all this trouble? I'm going to lock him up. Satan's going to be locked up. I'm going to lock up. These demons aren't going to be allowed to mess with you. You can't say that's the reason why you sin. They're locked up. But at the very end, God releases Satan. Not to go after the redeemed saints. They've already been taken care of. It's to take care of all the children who have not yet been tested. Because nobody gets to the new creation without going through the ultimate test. And the promise we have here is that if we receive help from God, we will pass that test. If we don't, we will fail.
Where does the rapture come in that scenario?
Well, premillennialists have many different rapture theories. And it was back in 1978 that I wrote a 26-page paper on all these different rapture theories. I have no idea where that paper is today. It's floating around somewhere. But that's where I lay out all the different models about when it happens. But I'll tell you this as a quick overview. I think the reason why we have so many different rapture models is people look at the dates in the book of Daniel and in Revelation for the events in the period of tribulation before the millennium, and they think those dates are accurate to four places of the decimal. Kind of like what I said about the 120 years. We shouldn't read that as accurate to three places of the decimal. It's accurate to two places of the decimal. Likewise, my view is that these events about the rapture are accurate to three places of the decimal, not four places of the decimal. And so my critique of a lot of these people who talk about the rapture is they're pinning too much precision on what the text is actually declaring. And so all the events are plus or minus 10 days. So my particular view is that the rapture of the church takes place 1 to 3 weeks before the middle of the tribulation. So, by the way, we did, I mean, Jackie Stewart's probably the only one here who remembers that time where we did about 6 or 7 months where that was our whole topic. We looked at about 8 different rapture models. And I had the class, I didn't really get involved much. I had the class go through the entire Bible and all the relevant texts and not so relevant texts and catalog how many of them scored on each of the different rapture models.
What year was this?
Oh, that would have been probably 1978 or 79. Jackie would remember, so you can ask her.
California back in 19-
well, a lot of you weren't even born back then, so But by the way, what's interesting is after all these decades have gone by, I still stand by what I taught back there in the 1978. I see no reason to change what I taught there. But I think what made the class fun is the class had the opportunity to actually go through the text and say, okay, this particular view gets 67% of the passages. This one gets 72%. This one gets 78%. And I actually demonstrated why there's so much debate in this issue. Because with the exception of two of the rapture models, they all got a majority of the scripture text, but none of them got 100%. And the only way you can get that 100% is to loosen up on the four places of the decimal. So you say, okay, we only got three decimal point precision, then you can come up with models where you actually can have all the passages fit that particular interpretation. And it's not just one model that would fit. So again, but I think that's one reason why you won't find this in any of the creeds of the church. What is in the creeds of the church, the Lord will return. When and how, there's a lot of debate in that issue. And, hey, come and join us for lunch at Reasons to Believe, and you get to hear a lot of that debate. That was fun, as we'll be having a rather vigorous debate and a whole lot of people to join us.
I'm not quite understanding what you mean by the three and four decimal places in terms of going these numbered years in Daniel and how that's going.
Well, notice in Daniel, when it speaks about this tribulation period, they'll talk about 1,290 days, another place 1,260 days. You've got Revelation speaking about 3.5 years. And what happens is people say, okay, that's exactly 3.5 or exactly 1,260. And what I'm suggesting is, how about plus or minus 10 on each of those dates? And that actually allows you to slip things around enough that you can get all the passages to fit. It's also consistent with repeated texts that says no one knows the hour or the day. In fact, what we did during 78 or 79, again, Jackie will know, is that we looked at all the different texts where God was bringing about a fulfillment of prophecy. And as you notice, every time you look at one of those texts, the individuals at that time did not know the date any more accurately than about plus or minus 1 week. Beginning with Noah, God told Noah to get in the ark and close the door. He had to wait 7 more days before the rain came down. God did not tell him when the rain was going to come down. He just knew it was the approximate time.
Which, so you would stand behind imminency or not?
Depends what you mean by imminency. Tell me what you mean by imminency and I'll tell you whether I stand by it or not.
The rapture could happen tomorrow. That's imminent.
No, I don't take that position. My particular position is based on 2 Thessalonians 2, which states that when the tribulation period begins, Christians will know that this is the Antichrist that's pulling this off. But the non-Christians won't know. The non-Christians will realize, yeah, this is this Antichrist figure when you come towards the events of the middle. What that tells me is that Christians had to be around for at least the first part of the tribulation period. And so, my critique of people who say it could happen tomorrow, all you need to do is look at the passages in Ezekiel concerning the rebirth of the nation of Israel. Those passages make it clear that this tribulation period can't begin until all the Jews in the world, or almost all the Jews in the world, are living in the land of Israel. Right now you've got more Jews in New York City than you've got living in Tel Aviv.
But that's saying that the rapture and the tribulation have to happen simultaneously, and I don't know that you can...
Well, I have friends who are premillennial and pre-tribulation. They believe that Christians will be raptured at the beginning of the seven-year period. That's not my position. I think it's 1 to 3 weeks before the middle. But even those people, I'd say, it can't be imminent because certain things have to happen in Israel first before the clock can tick. Now, a lot has happened. I mean, as I read Ezekiel, a whole lot's been fulfilled telling us that time is at hand. But several things have not yet happened. Israel is still armed to the teeth. We're told there in Ezekiel that a time will come when Israel will have no visible arms. A time will come when they'll be in political control of the ancient territories of Ammon, Moab, and Edom, but they will not possess it. Now, what's interesting is it was Winston Churchill in 1918 who boasted that he created the nation of Transjordan with a stroke of his pen. He says, I did it with just my pen. But his pen stroke perfectly encompassed the territories of Ammon, Moab, and Edom, and no others. So the stroke of his pen fulfilled that biblical prophecy. Part of it. Because one part has not yet been fulfilled. Israel does not yet politically control the nation of Jordan. But I think what we're seeing hinted at least in Ezekiel, is that there's a text that says that so many Jews will return to the land of Israel and say, there's not enough room here for all of us. You've got to give us more land. And so that, I think, will initiate the plan of solving the Palestinian crisis. Palestinians, you're on that side of the Jordan. We Jews are on this side of the Jordan. And so then the land will be big enough to accommodate 14 million Jews. The other thing the text says is that Israel as a nation will become the richest nation on the planet. Now, I believe that's meant to be per capita. And Israel's not there yet. They're not the richest nation on the planet on a per capita basis. On the other hand, they're well on the way. What's interesting, if you look at the companies that are listed on NASDAQ, the nation that's got the most NASDAQ companies is the United States. Israel is second. So it's ahead of Germany. It's ahead of Japan. Here's this nation of 7 million people, and they're the number two on the NASDAQ exchange. They got the highest percentage per capita of people who are computer programmers and people who are physicists. And that's why there's so many NASDAQ companies, basically Israeli software companies. So, and maybe that could explain why they can get rid of their arms. Because more and more they're relying on their software capability for part of their defense. But the whole point is, even for those who believe in a pre-tribulation rapture, it can't be imminent. Those things have not yet happened. When Israel lays down its arms, it could happen any day. But until that happens, it can't happen any day. And it's got to also become the wealthiest nation, and the Jews all have to be living there. So, this afternoon, Ezekiel 32 to Ezekiel 40. Read those nine chapters.
Okay.
You'll see that and a whole lot more that is prophesied to take place in the nation of Israel. And by the way, this is part of my conversion experience when I was a teenager, reading those texts where it says that the birth of the nation of Israel will happen when the unbelieving Gentile nations see huge valleys filled with the bones of dead Jews. And that was the Holocaust.
Sure.
You know, some of the valleys had more than 100,000 skeletons in them. And also what you see there in Ezekiel, when the unbelieving Gentile nations see those valleys filled with the bones of your people, they will say Israel as a nation will never happen. And yet that was the day when Israel was born. Because I remember reading newspapers, microfiche of newspapers, which you could see in 1947. That was when they released these photos of these huge valleys filled with these hundreds of thousands of Jewish skeletons.
I've seen photos. I wasn't born then.
No, I wasn't around then either. But I went to the library and dug up all the microfiche at age 16 and began to go through all those newspapers and say, I wonder what I'm seeing here in Ezekiel has actually happened. But what's really interesting, when you look at those newspapers, you also see headlines. Zionism is done. There will be no nation Israel. Why? Because they said the greatest Holocaust damage took place in Poland. And Poland was the heart of the movement to establish Israel as a nation. So they said with the death of those 4 million plus Jews in Poland, there will never be a nation Israel. Yet a few months later, it was born.
May 14th, 1948.
Yes.
What was Britain's purpose? First, you know, when World War II ended, there was a mass migration to Israel of Jews that was resisted to some degree, and there was
yes.
a lot of, you know, people going regardless of that. But it also formed what we know today as the Middle East, the countries, the boundaries, and what was it the fact that Britain was in such depletion from World War II that they just gave up control of that and India? Or, you know, they just saw the political...
Well, that's an interesting history to read. And I actually read that before I gave my life to Christ. I said, what's going on here? Well, if you read the history of the early 40s and right after the war, Britain's policy was to try to keep both the Jews happy and the Arabs happy. And they quickly figured that the more they tried to keep both sides happy, the angrier both sides got at them. And both sides began killing British soldiers. So they said, you know what? We can't get them to like one another. We're just going to leave. And that's when they began to push the UN, okay, we need to partition things, and because they want it out. Because they realize this is a no-win situation. There's no way that we're going to make these people like one another. And the more we try, the more angry they're getting at us. So, for example, you had Jewish squads basically running around blowing up British military installations. And then the British said, well, if we're going to keep the Arabs happy, we got to stop the Jews from coming in. And so there was this exodus out of Eastern Europe trying to make their way into Israel. And yeah, the Western nations are basically trying to stop it. Mainly because you had both Britain and France trying to keep peace in this region. And eventually they both pulled out. Now they tried to get back in 56. And that's a whole other story. So.
But the Arabs resisted in 47, correct? At the formation of Israel. That was the first conflict.
Well... They thought, okay, I mean, we got these British and French trying to appease us. Maybe they'll get rid of the Jews for us. But what they discovered is the British and the French were not prepared to go that far. So that's when they came with a partition plan. And that's when the Arabs said, let's get a confederacy together and we'll drive the Jews into the sea, force them out. And that was the birth of Israel. By the way, you'll also see that when you read Ezekiel 32-40, is that once the nation is formed, God would fight for them against their Arab neighbors like he did in the days of old, referring back to the Old Testament. But here's something else that's chilling. It says, I will perform miracles for them on the battlefield. And you can easily document that God has done exactly that. But notice what it says there in Ezekiel. My people will not give me credit. They will claim we are the ones that got these great victories. We did it by our own hand. But he says, the Gentiles will give me credit. The Jews won't, but the Gentiles will. And he says, that's why I'm forming this nation. I'm forming it to get the attention of the Gentiles that they will come to faith in Christ. Now, I've lived long enough to see that very thing happen, where a lot of Gentiles, because of what's going on in the nation of Israel, have realized there's a God out there, and what he has prophesied in the Old Testament is coming true, literally before our eyes. I remember doing that back in the 80s, just talking to unbelievers and saying, okay, look what God did 2,000 years ago. He brought Jesus of Nazareth to demonstrate that what the prophets of old said really was true, and therefore we need to pay attention. God's doing the same thing in our day. He is allowing prophecy to be fulfilled right before our eyes so that we can see, just like people in the days of Jesus of Nazareth could see, that the Old Testament has predictive power. It has predictive power for us today. And by the way, there's an extension of that. If God's that involved in the new nation of Israel, chances are he's involved in your life as an individual human being. And this is where I think the challenge lies. God has been performing miracles in our life, and we don't realize it. So don't blame the Jews. They're saying, God wasn't involved. We did it all by our own power. Well, likewise, we very often think, okay, all these great things that have happened in my life, all these deliverances from disasters that have happened in my life, I must be a great guy. That's why it's happened. No, it was God miraculously intervening to save you from your stupidity and foolishness, and we need to give God the appropriate credit. And I'm way over time, aren't I? Sorry, I'm cutting into your time. Let me close.
One comment, obviously, is I do believe the Bible teaches intimacy, and in the sense, obviously, I've had non-believers come back at me and say, well, you know, the Bible obviously contradicts itself because it says, obviously, that you should live your life as this Christ is coming tomorrow, and yet these prophecies aren't finished. And obviously, we need to point out, obviously, that when the Bible talks about intimacy, is the Lord could return tomorrow, and or we're supposed to live our life as if tomorrow could be our last day. Because it could be. We may have, somebody here in the class may not be here, and it could be that number class members go to be with the Lord and live our life on as every day is the last day, because either Christ could return and or you could be meeting the Lord tomorrow.
Yeah, so no matter what happens, it could be imminent.
Yep.
So I thought it might have been imminent this morning when I was on the freeway. So
if I'm going to get prepared lunch over here, so those that are staying to hear Wes, the two ways, and so your wife,
Jackie,
and you, I've got Jackie Wade, too. Jackie is going to be sharing briefly, but we'll have a short break for people to have conversations while I set up the food, and then I'll interrupt again so we can pray for the lunch that's being served. So if you have time to stay and hear Wes, we will be serving light refreshments over here and having Wes start shortly. So if you pray.
Yeah, Father in Heaven, we do want to thank you for this wonderful creation that you've put together. And Lord, help us to see the intricacy of everything you've done and how it's all there for the benefit of us human beings and us as individuals. Lord, I pray too that you would give us, open up our eyes so we can see all the miracles that you performed on behalf of humanity, but especially, Lord, on behalf of every one of us as an individual human being. Thank you, Lord, that you created us. Thank you that you love us. Thank you that you mean good things for us, and even greater reward in the life to come. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.